We had a very beautiful seminar from Dorit Aronoff 2 days ago, telling us about the accuracy threshold and try to improve it. And one thing that was not totally clear, however, in her presentation is that the accuracy threshold depends on the assumption that you're using for the error model. That is, you change the type of error that you have, you change the threshold that you have. Example of this is, you might have seen in Manny's lectures, that if you have an error which is a projection in the z-basis, then whatever the value of this error is, you can have the threshold is such that it is 1. That is, any value of the error occurs, then you can compute in a reliable way. So there, you have a very simple error model, projection in the z-basis on a qubit that you know. Now, the model that Dorit was talking about was something like a statistically independent error from qubit to qubit, and it could be depolarizing, like some random sigma z, sigma y, sigma x. So with this value, she was going to get something, or she claims she could get maybe up to 1 over 200, but the value that she get at the end was 10 to the minus 4. So really, what is the error model that we have in physical system? And the work I've been doing with my colleague Manny Knill, David Corey, Tim Havel, Rudy Martinez, Camille Grevin, and Wojciech Zurich in an MR is try to understand what are reasonable error models. In fact, sometimes I like to think of these experiments in an MR, not when they work, but when they fail for an interesting reason. Or when they fail at the first shot, then suddenly we think that we have been clever and found a way to make them work. And I hope during my talk I'll give a few examples of these things, of where we can improve, how can we control quantum system. And that's the way I'm thinking about these NMR experiments. So here's the very brief overview of my talk. I will talk about what is NMR quantum computing, going over some of Ike's concepts and comments, and but think about them in terms of when do they work, and when are the imperfection, and when they don't work all the time perfectly, and what do we do about this? Then I'll comment about a few experiments that we've done recently, implementing the 5-bit code, and implementing a subsystem where we can have 1 qubit of quantum information, and show how can we think about them as some kind of benchmark for quantum information processing. How can we think about these and think if tomorrow we would get 30, 40, 50 qubits? What are kind of the interesting questions we can ask about these systems, and how can we trust them? In fact, if we'd have a 50-qubit quantum computer today, and somebody would go and do something, nobody would be able to say, is this the right result or not? And we should start to think about this, and a device like an NMR spectrometer is a good one to start with it, because it is a physical system, and we are restricted by a lot of constraint. And we try to figure out exactly what are those constraints. And finally, because there was a talk by Ivan Deutsch on kind of scalable quantum computation, I'll go back on the power of quantum computing, because NMR kind of questioned some of the preconception that some people had about where is this power coming from. And like Ivan, I will not have a definite answer, but at least I'll remind you of one algorithm, the power of 1 bit of quantum information, which is rather puzzling when you think about it in terms of, for example, entanglement, or where is the power really coming from. So I'll keep this for the end, kind of. It always starts good debates also, so I'll keep this till last minute. So the basic idea of liquid state NMR is to have a liquid of molecules which have spin half particles in them. It could be something else than spin half, but spin half is very convenient because they don't interact with electric field, so they are much more robust than spin one or higher spins. So let's think of a molecule like trichloroethylene. We have 2 carbons here, 1 hydrogen. If we put them in a strong magnetic field in the z direction, let's say 11 Tesla, the hydrogen spin will rotate at a Larmor frequency of around 500 megahertz. The carbons around 125 megahertz. And because of the electronic structure of this molecule, the first carbon will have a slightly different Larmor frequency than the other. This is called a chemical shift. And because they are different, it allows us to act on the first carbon without having to act on the second one. So So that's how we distinguish the different qubits, is that they have different Larmor frequencies. So by sending RF pulse in a little core like this, we can do what we call one qubit rotation. In fact, at first sight with this geometry, it's hard to see that the magnetic field would be in the plane perpendicular to Z, but it's a nice little arrangement, and you could think about it also as a coil that's in the X plane, and this will send kind of qubit in some rotation, some direction. There is an interaction between nearby spins, which is mediated by, again, the electron cloud. And this induces an interaction which is of the form sigma z, sigma z. And with the single pulse that we have, single qubit pulse in this, we can go and manipulate the spin and make them kind of dance around and do various things. How do we measure the result of our computation or the experiment that we've been doing? When the spin are in the XY plane, they rotate again at this Larmor frequency, they induce a little current on this coil. You can go and look at this current. It makes a little graph like this. It decays because of the T2 in the system before you transform this. And the height of these peaks give you an idea of how many of these molecules were in that particular state. You can think about what you see here as the transition from a spin going up and down, and depending on what is the value of the other spin, if you have some G coupling of that form. I'll come back to this in a few minutes. Well, these devices are amazing at doing unitary transformation. So everything that we do seems to be according to the rules of quantum mechanics. That is, we do an experiment, we think of those spins having some Hamiltonian, and we act on them with the RF pulse, and everything seems to be incredibly good. In fact, it's rather surprising that it is that good. And it is that good because it has very, very good timing. Like the spin rotates at 500 megahertz. When you pulse, you pulse at a specific time when the spin passes some direction. And these devices to me have surprised me how accurate they are. But they are not completely isolated from the environment, and there are relaxation term, T1. So in this molecule, the relaxation is around 30 seconds at 11 tesla between the two carbon, and the hydrogen relaxed to about 5 seconds. If you look at the T2, which is the dephasing in the XY plane, then this occurs at around 1 second. So these are the limit at which we can say we have done unitary transformation. Beyond about 1 second after we start the experiment, then definitely there are non-unitary parts of the evolution which comes in. Of course, before we go and do all of this, we have to go and find some molecule. And we're lucky at Los Alamos, we have Rudy Martinez, who works in the stabilized isotope laboratory. And what they do is not kind of a very small fraction of their time is working on quantum computation. Most of their time is to work at trying to synthesize molecule with carbon 13 at various places. So they can trace where this molecule goes in some biological system. And you can turn this into an advantage for quantum computation because he knows how to synthesize different type of molecule. And for example, here's carbonic acid. And he was able to synthesize one with carbon 13 on the four of those carbon and with the hydrogen around. So how do we go and choose a molecule? Well, we have a set of criteria. I mentioned the chemical shift. The difference between the frequency between these carbon have to be large enough, because if we want to pulse on one, if the chemical shift is delta, the amount of time it will take so that we don't affect another one is roughly 1 over delta. So if we do this, and we also want to have large decoherence time, so different molecules will have different decoherence time. For example, here, if we have a chlorine instead of an oxygen, then the system will act on our spin and make it decoher faster. So you have to go and look at molecules so that decoherence time are large. And finally, we want to have strong coupling. And this is a bit of a black art of finding exactly what is the coupling between those different systems. And so you go and do some trial and error. In fact, there's tons of organic molecules which are cataloged with their spectra. And you can go and look one after the other and see how many molecules with, let's say, 4 carbon and 3 hydrogen that you can find. So this is the theoretical approach. And you go to the library and go look at it. Well, it works much better when you have a friend who visits Los Alamos and come for dinner, who is an NMR spectroscopist, and tell you that he has done his PhD thesis on this molecule. And that was Serge Lasserre, who came 2 or 3 years ago to Los Alamos and told us that with the criteria we wanted, we should go and look at this. And that's really how we got that molecule. If you try to make molecule much larger, it seems to be a lot harder to find one with all these criteria. And maybe there's a hidden exponential in there when you try to go to larger and larger molecule, if you don't want to have some symmetry, if you want to have a system which distinguish all those spins and be with having large chemical shift, then it becomes very, very hard. Well, typically, if you look at carbon, the chemical shift is divided in an area of about 200 ppm, 200 part per million of the field that you have. If you want to have about, if you want to be at 11 Tesla, that means about 20 kilohertz that you want out here. You want the separation of 1 kilohertz between every qubit so that you can act on them on something around 1 millisecond. It tells you you could not have more than 20. And then you have to cross your finger that your chemistry is very good so that they are spread evenly on there. To go for much more, let's say, than 10 carbon on one, then becomes very much, much harder. So we have two types of gate, as I mentioned. The 1-bit gate and the 2-bit gate, you can act on with hard pulse, which does not distinguish from one spin to the other, and affect all the, let's say, all the carbon in one shot, or all the hydrogen. Or you can use soft pulse, which are take a time one over the chemical shift. In both of them, you have problem with off-resonance and the occurrence time during your pulse. Although here you cannot do selective pulse, then at least these pulses are very short, very little decoherence. But if you have soft pulse, then you can start to see the decoherence during the time that you do your pulse. So doing a pulse, let's say if you take the spin in the z direction, you make a pulse around the x direction by an angle theta, it's going to bring the different operator. X, y, z are Pauli operators, and you can manipulate the density matrix of the system by doing pulse of that shape, that type. You can go and do 2-bit gates, the type of interaction is sigma z, sigma z. And the effect of this is to increase the Larmor frequency of the second spin if the first one is pointing up. And if the first spin is pointing down instead, the effect is really to decrease the Larmor frequency a little bit. Although these 1-bit gate and 2-bit gate sounds to be like a classical spin evolution, if the first spin is in a superposition of up and down, then definitely the two spin would go in two different, the second spin would go in two different directions at the same time if you would try to do this with a classical model. So with this, you can look at the evolution of certain operators. So this is the Hamiltonian for a certain time, which induces a phase phi. And if you look at an operator like x tensor 1, under the evolution of this operator, you get that it goes to x tensor 1. And this should be a phi in there, and then a yz. So if you want to put this for a time pi over 4, then x1 goes to the operator yz. Well, there are coupling between all the atoms in our system, and I'll show a spectrum in a few minutes. So there are ways that we can find to cancel out this evolution, and refocusing is one of them. If you have this evolution here during that time here, and you do an x rotation of 180 degrees, the operator x for the second qubit, then you leave the same evolution as you had at the beginning, and you do this rotation x by 180 degrees, the operator x, you have then an evolution which is this one here, then x, this one here, and x. You can bring the two x up in the exponential. This will effectively change the sign minus here to a plus, and then the two evolution will cancel. So using that technique, you can modulate the interaction. In fact, this idea is not new. It kind of at least go back to John Waugh at MIT, who thought about manipulating nuclear spin by varying by kind of shaping different pulse and make kind of this interaction to look having different strength and different shape. If we do a rotation around different axis, we can have, for example, this looking like XZ instead of ZZ. So with this, we can go back to quantum information and write this in terms of quantum circuit. But the whole idea of manipulating the Hamiltonian is not something which is new in NMR. There's another gate that we can use, which is a gradient. So we have the strong field in the z direction, and what we do is making a pulse, a gradient pulse, which is a linear gradient. And what does that do is that in the reference frame of the Larmor frequency of a spin, it is going to make the spin go in on an helicoil, which is proportional to the z direction. So if you make a pulse like this, a gradient pulse, then you're going to label the creation operator, x plus iy, with a phase in there, and the magnetization will disappear. If you put another pulse in the direction inverse, then the magnetization will come back. In some sense, this is some kind of decoherence, and I'll show in a few minutes how you can use this to for various tasks. But the interesting thing is that it labels the creation operator in a certain way. There are different ways that you can think about modulating the pulse. And the one at MIT is to, if you want to induce a pulse, let's say on x rotation around two spin, you can drive the system very rapidly so that most of the interaction, well, all the interaction that you have, the natural Hamiltonian of a system, cancel except what you want, for example, a pi pulse over the spin 1 and 2. So it is possible to do this by pulsing very rapidly, making this Hamiltonian average to a desired one. And that is the technique that MIT has decided to use. And with this, they were able to have very short pulse time, but with lots of power. In order to do this, you have to know very well your Hamiltonian, and then you you go on a classical computer and see what kind of pulse, which is defined by its phase and its power, so that it averages to a certain value. Us in Los Alamos decided to go in a slightly different direction by thinking that what we are able to do very well in an MR spectrometer is rotation around X or Y axis. And it's very precise, the angle between X and Y. So we decided to do rotation only in the X or the, anywhere in the X-Y rotation. If we have to do a Z rotation, we could do this with combining X and Y rotation, because the sigma the Pauli matrices do not commute. But we can also think about doing a Z rotation by changing reference frame. And it becomes very good, because these Z rotation are perfect. Like, you just have to think about it, calculate classically when you want to have a Z rotation, instead of having an X rotation after a Z rotation, you will have the X rotation rotated by 90 degrees. So by doing this, we can avoid all the Z rotation that we have in our system. And it works very well because the Hamiltonian interaction Hamiltonian that we have is a form sigma ZZ, which commutes with the Z rotation. So we, doing this, we can go and calculate, save quite a lot of pulse. So the technique that we've been using to do our experiments is first going to look at the molecule that we have, look at how it works, assume that we have a certain shape for our pulse, rewrite this the effect of this pulse in terms of the effect on other spins up to a ZZ rotation and a Z rotation. So we can go and do this. Once we have this all together, and we have a table of what is the effect of a certain pulse on the nuclei that we want and the other ones, we bring this together and we compile a set of pulse up to this table, which tells us how imperfect they are. But it's only the imperfection in Z and ZZ that we take into account. Bringing this together, we can go from an algorithm, a quantum circuit. We write a pulse. We write a small program telling us that what we want to do is an interaction between spin 1 and spin 2, but nothing on the third or fourth or fifth spin. We can cancel these extra interaction by refocusing pulse, and this is done automatically with a pulse sequence compiler. So we ask the computer to write this pulse sequence and go and look at what it looks in detail. And this is all automated so that we just have to write this kind of precompiled pulse sequence. After that, we have to do calibration of the system. Again, this is all automated, and we can go and do experimental preparation, run of the experiments, data, and analysis. This is what our precompiling pulse look like if we want to transfer the polarization from this atom, or the carbon 1 to carbon 2, so that the fourth here to the fifth one, we write that we want to do a pulse between C2 by an angle of 0.25, or which means a 90 degree, a ZZ rotation. Meanwhile, we don't want to have interaction between the first three spin, and so we have a refocusing here of the hydrogen, and this can be a hard pulse, can be done so that M, H1, and H2 do not have effective interaction. And our pulse compiler translates this into a sequence of comments, and also gives us a hint of where the errors occurred when we do this, so we can go and minimize these errors. Another place where we have worked a little bit hard is on RF selection. One of the type of error that we have in our system is when we do a 90 degree on the pulse, if the spins are, for example, nearby the side of the tube, there will be a defect due to susceptibility, which will change the Larmor frequency by a little bit. And then if you calibrate the pulse at the middle, the spin in the middle by exactly, let's say, 90 degree, the one on the side will be slightly off resonance and will come at some noise, and you will lose some signal. By doing a sequence of pulse together, we can take a subsample of our sample, which is RF homogeneous to a high degree. We can decide which degree we want by increasing the number of pulse here. This means 64 times this angle rotation of 180 degree around phi I and minus phi I. And when we do this with 64 of these pulse, we have a RF inhomogeneity of around plus or minus 2%. So this means that all the spins which have a Larmor frequency in such a way that they have a power for 90 degree, which is within the plus or minus 2% of the middle, will be kept in that system. All the other spins are randomized around. And so if you try to do many of those 180 degrees, then you get it to a high accuracy. If you don't do something like an RF selection, then you do three rotation around, let's say, the z-axis, and what you get is the spin get randomized. This is not the coherence, because you can reverse those three rotation, and you get back the maximization again. So this is an effect of having lots of molecule which don't see exactly the same field, and RF selection help us how to do this. So what kind of experiments have we been looking at? Well, we've been looking at some which tells us some kind of benchmark for quantum devices. In particular, what we wanted to show is the ability to control the system. So we want to have an idea of how we go and give an algorithm so that it's a good representative of how much control that we have. We're always looking for things which are scalable, at least in principle. And we'd like at some point to have a benchmark which is device dependent, so independent, so we can compare one system to the other. An example of of this benchmark is to create a pseudo-cat state or pseudo-pure state in NMR. This is a very specific to NMR, but you could generalize it to a cat state in that system and look how good you are at doing that state. Well, the reason why we were interested in this is that the type of gate that you are using there are very similar to fault torrent operation. In fact, it's an encoding of if you start with the big state and go towards the pseudo-cat state, it's really an encoding of a system so that you would be invariant around the Z direction. So for NMR people, this is equivalent to create N coherence. So I talk about doing the state preparation this morning. One thing which I want to point out is that there are algorithms where you have to start with a pure state, and there are other algorithms where you might not have to start with a pure state. And a little bit later, I'll talk about an algorithm where you start with an initial density matrix would be only I minus beta sigma z, where you destroy the rest of the polarization and all the other spin. So if you would do this, this would be a scalable initial state by doing this, because it's easy to destroy the polarization. This can be done with n minus one pulse, which would reverse the direction and do twice the same experiment at both of them. The only thing which would be left would be the I minus beta sigma z. Other algorithm starts with a pure state. Ike very briefly mentioned this, and he mentioned a way out to do this using the a time sequence of using the same experiment with a slightly different initial preparation step before. What we've been using in Los Alamos is another way where we do the pseudo-pure state in one shot using this gradient idea. So the basic idea is to start with a polarization. So we kill all the polarizations here. We start with Zi, which is this term here. So here I'm going to do it for only 2 qubits, but you can imagine the same thing would happen. In fact, this diagram cascades, and you could kind of generalize it very easily. You rotate it so that you end up with a form of yx. And if you write yx in terms of creation annihilation operator, you'll have something of this form with 2i plus i plus, 1i plus i plus, 1i minus i minus, and then i plus i minus. If you put a gradient field on this, the terms I plus and plus, I plus will get twice the phase of the gradient. The terms I plus, I minus will not have any phase due to the gradient. Now you do the reverse of these gates, so it's equivalent to a decoding. And if you look at the part which comes from I plus, you can go and decode it, and what you end up at the end is x plus y, 1 minus z. If you go and do the same thing with I minus, you'll get x minus y, 1 minus z. If you go and look at the terms which are I plus I minus, what you would get is x plus or minus y, I plus z, if you do this, and end up here and put a gradient field, which is minus twice the strength of here, then the terms which came from I plus will have no net phase. All the other terms which came from I plus I minus will get a phase terms. It will disappear in your system. With this, you are able to isolate terms which are of the form x, 1 minus z. And this corresponds to absurd pure state, because x is the transition of flipping from up to down, when the other spin here is 1 minus z. Example of this for this molecule here, when, so this is the spectrum of the carbon 1. There is, as Ike mentioned this morning, 64 of those lines. And when you calculate all of this, then you realize that there's only one line left, because we have the state 1 minus z, 1 minus z, 1 minus z, 1 minus z. So you have isolated only one of the transition, and all the other spins are all pointing up. So once you have a state of that form, you can go and implement various circuits. Here, we've implemented the 5-bit quantum error correction. And here's another example where, when you have a physical system, you can go and look at what are the assumptions in error correction. My first bet when I started to think about this is that the 7-bit code, because it has a lot of symmetry, would be a lot easier to implement. But it turns out that if you try to do this, it has a lot of symmetry, but you have to do a lot of gates between not adjacent qubits. And if you go and look at the circuit, and you're limited to just adjacent coupling, it becomes a lot harder. So doing the 7-qubit would be a lot harder than doing the 5-bit code if you just have nearby interaction. And thus, we settled down to do the 5-bit code. We did this 5-bit code. You remember that you can encode, and then an error will occur here. We put the error by hand, which can be nothing, or sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, on any of those 5 qubits. So that gives you 16 possibilities. And if you decode the system at the end and do the error correction, then you look if you get the signal. And there's 16 of those graphs here, which correspond to have no error, or one error, or no error, an error, a Z error on the methyl group, Y error on the methyl group, etc., all of them. This is, again, the spectrum of the carbon 1. And we were able to show that the peak moves a little bit, because the 4 other spins correspond to what the syndrome of the error came in. If you take the integral of the peak, you get, in fact, the signal has been conserved, and you've done the error correction. I'm slowly running out of time, so I was going to mention something about noiseless subsystem, but instead I'm going to go and talk a little bit about the power of quantum computing. When we first learn about NMR, it seems to be kind of like crazy that you can do coherent evolution in that system. And the reason is that the frequency that we are dealing with, h bar omega, compared to the temperature, is very, very small. It's about between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 4. And having Wojciech Zurek in the office next to mine in Los Alamos you would have come and bashed me on the head thinking of we could do quantum information processing with system like this. But it turns out that even if the thermal density matrix is extremely mixed, on some time scale, which is smaller than T2, we seem to be doing very good unitary evolution. And this is because the system seems to be isolated very well from its environment on these time scales. So if you look at books on NMR, if you look at the books in the 1960s, they will tell you that NMR is all classical. And as the time evolved, then people started to become more and more not at ease with this statement. And in particular, there's a lot of solid-state NMR where people work on coherences. Ike mentioned this morning where you have all those 100 spins kind of pointing up and plus down at the same time. And these are very hard to explain with classical models. It is possible, but all of them seem to fail in one way or the other. And I'm coming back to this in a minute. But if you look at the book by Ernst, more recent in the 90s, he says that the dynamics of isolated spins can be understood in terms of motion of classical magnetization vectors. To describe coupled spin, however, it is necessary to have recourse to quantum mechanical formalism, where the state of the system is expressed by a state function, or more generally, by the density operator. So when you have a coupling between the qubit, it seems that the classical models, or the naive classical analog, fails. A year ago, Jarrah Milburn, myself, Barry Sanders, and Nani look at a case of two spin coupled with each other. And we were wondering, why is this true, that when they are coupled, something happens? So we look at two spin interacting with the J-coupling of the form JZ-JZ. And this commutes with the total angular momentum. So if you start with the spin one subspace of those two spin, it will remain in the spin one. So you can go and solve this exactly. And you can think about this as a classical little magnet going around. And this turns into a quadratic part of the Hamiltonian. You can look at it and evolve it. Or you can do the quantum evolution. And if you go and do this, what you find out, this thing is called, it's the probability of being an occurrence state of this SUT space. If you do the classical evolution, having started with one of those occurrence states, the classical evolution kind of whirls up around. And if you look at the quantum evolution, even with the resolution of the screen here, you can see it is different. So why is it different? Well, you can go and look at the propagator, how you evolve the density matrix. And what you see when you look at the quantum propagator is there are terms which are not positive. And these non-positive terms come in effect the system and leads to a different evolution. In fact, there's two classical limits that you can consider here. If J is equal to zero, then the propagator becomes positive and is the same as two classical spin rotating around. The other classical limit is if you add decoherence to that system. If you have a phase randomization with the same phase on both spin, you can find out that you can see that this propagator suddenly will become positive. So if we kind of had started with quantum computation instead, we've learned from Richard Yoza and Arthur Eckert that if we start with pure state and we don't have entanglement, we can simulate the system efficiently by a classical system. So, and the second element in this is that Brownstein et al. Showed that there's no entanglement in an NMR quantum computation if you have less than 13 qubits. So why should we be interested in going again and looking at these systems? Well, the real reason is they behave like quantum system, and we can learn how to kind of control them. But we can go and push this a little bit more and say, well, first, this argument of Yoza and Eckert fails if you use density matrix instead of initial pure state. So that's the first element. The second one is, well, quantum computation is inherently a dynamical process. And that was realized by Shack and Cave, who tried to find a model not only of claiming that there's no entanglement, but looking at a classical evolution. And their model fails by having an exponential decay of signal, like the 7-bit pseudo-pure state that we showed. If you go and look at their model, we'd have a decay of signal of 10 to the minus 46. So you would not have seen anything if this would have been the real model for the NMR experiment. There's another more recent model by Kalkave and Minukuchi, but again, you have a system where you have an exponential number of resources. I want to finish with one thing, which is, if it is or not quantum, we don't have the real answer. But if we have algorithms which are a lot more powerful in an idealized system of NMR, then it's rather puzzling that if this system would be really a classical system. And a few years ago, Manik Neal and myself proposed this this algorithm. And the basic idea, and it's called the power of one bit, because one bit is in a pseudo-pure state. The other bits are in a completely mixed state. And then we do a control gate. So we first make an atom arch, transform the sigma z into a sigma x. We do a control, and the sigma x is a 0 in place of 1. So the 0 doesn't do anything, but the 1 will bring a u in the matrix, the trace of, if we trace over all the qubits and look at this matrix, density matrix. Same part for 1, 0. And doing this and looking at the expectation value of sigma x, we find that this expectation value is proportional to the polarization and multiplied by the trace, or the real part of the trace of u. Trying to find this classically seems to be incredibly hard. At least we don't have an efficient classical algorithm to do this. And what we can find out with this, suppose that u is the Hamiltonian, is the distribution of eigenvalue of that system. The only way we can think about how to do this classically is to diagonalize the system. This takes exponential amount of time. On a system like this, then it's efficient. This initial state is efficient because it's only one spin being polarized. It doesn't have to be polarized to one value. A pseudo-pure state is fine. Pseudo-pure state only brings a constant in front. So for anybody who says that NMR is not scalable, but indeed, if you want to do a pseudo-pure state with all the state, a pseudo-pure state corresponding to 0, 0, 0, today we don't have enough control to do this. But if you look at this algorithm, it starts with a different initial state, which is scalable, and gives you an algorithm which has no efficient classical algorithm. So with all this, I'm running out of my time, and I'll finish here. Thank you. The whole correction step is independent of which error has occurred. Whoops. Huh. So when we do the error correction, we do this step after this step after this step. So it will correct all possible kinds of error that have occurred. If there are one bit error, will be corrected. So we do a unitary transformation, which says if you decode the system and you say there's been an error sigma x on this one, the unitary transformation takes care of this. And because all the different syndromes are orthogonal to each other, you can make a unitary evolution which corrects for all possible syndrome in one unitary evolution. Omegas for the hydrogen in a 11 Tesla magnet is about 500 megahertz. For the carbon is about 125 megahertz. The J couplings for the molecule that we've been investigating are between 200 to 40 hertz.
In the power of one qubit example, I just don't quite understand where you get the constant epsilon from, because you still need, let's say, you still need n qubits for the or this is what I've seen, is an n-qubit molecule, and if you lose an NMR, then the polarization per qubit is going to go down in a usual way. So why is the epsilon for the first qubit then constant?
Well, where is this? I've missed it somewhere. Well, the density matrix is e to the minus beta h. Let's assume there's no j because it's much smaller. So it goes like 1 minus beta omega 1 minus beta omega 2 sigma z plus the rest. So you could just kill the rest and you have one spin, which is 1 minus beta omega 1 sigma z. And so as long as you are able to thermalize rapidly, then you do have the right density matrix. So in fact, this model is weaker than NMR because you get rid of so much polarization. In fact, it's a nice counterexample, this 1 bit of one power of the power of 1 bit of quantum information. It is surprising. It doesn't seem to make sense when you first look at it because the density matrix is so mixed. And if you try to think about this classically, you start with an equal amount of garbage and 1 bit, and you seem to get an equal amount of information out of it. And it seemed to work because the phase are preserved, even if you have a mixed state.
I just wanted to comment on Rudiger's question.
Yeah.
So it's unnecessary, that's right. So with none of this sort of pure or effective pure state creation, epsilon is a constant. And that's why his example is so surprising.
Now that it's surprising, we should point out that if there is noise in the system, we don't know how to do error correction with such a mixed state. So then it's a model which is fragile towards noise. Although as an ideal system to show where is the origin of the power of quantum computation is a puzzle one. In fact, maybe the people who know a lot about entanglement, maybe they can tell me if these states are becoming entangled. Like a state of this form, this with epsilon, we can start epsilon 10 to the minus 5, and a 1 over 2 to the minus 1. You do a unitary evolution. So the density matrix here is going to pick up some mu's there, but it's only on one of the qubit. In fact, you go to very small part of the configuration space of that system. Like all the qubits remains in the completely mixed state. You're just doing some little thing on one of them. So it seems that it's only one qubit. Well, you get 1 bit of information on it only also. Yes? Yeah.
So in fact, you would typically the real sum there is your square root to the n minus 1, so you actually have to repeat this exponentially many times to see this expectation of it. So in fact, it's not really clear at all.
Well, we can ask the question, is this expectation value greater than 0.5 for a time 1 over pi squared? And I'm asking you, answer. Well, okay, if you go to random times, I do agree, but you could ask the question of... So you're saying it's not a very robust... I do agree that there's no proof that you cannot do it efficiently classically, and you have no proof that... because we know very little about the trace of those large operators, how do they behave? But think about...
Most of them behave
Yes. But you just need to find one which behaves nicely to see that this would have some power.
That's a very special one. But I'm just saying that the time is not very...
Well, look at when the time is small. Okay, we know that when the time is zero, the trace is one. And now you are, for a very small time, you'll learn about some of the eigenvalues. Maybe the first part of it. So look at it. Oh, no, but most of them, if time is much smaller than all of those, the lambda j, then you have lots of, these things will be very near one, all of them. We know at t equals zero, the sum is one. So do a perturbation for small times. And then you know that the sum has to start at one and then it's going to decrease. And you can make an estimate of what are those eigenvalues, maybe, and see what it is. Is it greater than 0.5 or not?
All right, well, maybe we'll take one more question. But then
I have a question about the example in which the implementation of this control unit is easy as a quantum circuit, while the computation of the trace of unit is difficult.
Yeah, thing about physical Hamiltonian. That's why I put this one. Then we know very little about, like, thing about H as being the Hubbard model, whether the trace of this operator.
Okay, well, let's thank Raymond for a very, very thoughtful.